This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for May 2010. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature a few poems and talk about an article in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from Linda Kuhnhart.
I find executives in my pants.
And from Andrew Hudgens.
I grinned and agreed. My voice greased with hidden envy.
We'll also speak with poet David Byspiel about what he calls the insularity of American poets.
In community after community, citizens have turned inward, and poets have taken it to be our calling to turn inward.
Also in this issue, we have a portfolio of poems by Eleanor Ross Taylor, who's the winner of the Poetry Foundation's 2010 Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize. The Lilly Prize honors poets for their lifetime achievement.
And what an accomplished life Eleanor Ross Taylor has had. When she published her first book, Randall Jarrell wrote the introduction to it, and when he won the National Book Award, he said he wished it had gone to her instead. He thought she was the better poet.
I wonder if he actually meant that, or
well,
who knows? Eleanor Ross Taylor is the widow of the novelist Peter Taylor. She was also friends with Alan Tate, Robert Lowell, and of course, Randall Jarrell, as Don said. But in spite of this sort of high-octane literary crowd and her distinguished body of work, her own poetry has not received all that much attention.
Yeah, and it's interesting to reflect on why that might be. Her work spans a very long period of time, many decades now, and I think some of the reasons are that she was a woman and had a famous husband, that she tended to her children and her family, and I also think that it was partly because she was from the South.
And she published sparingly. She published a book every 10 years or so, and she favored things like clarity and narrative at a time when poetry was really changing and, you might say, accelerating with postmodernism and now what they call post-avant styles. And she really was at the edges of all that.
Yeah, I think she wasn't inclined to put herself forward or, you know, to get out there and publicize what she was doing or thinking. But her work really stands up. And I think it stands up well in the light of all these movements that have come along in her time.
Here's an early poem by her. It's called To a Young Writer, and it gives you a sense of Eleanor Ross Taylor's life and the sort of oblique and yet steady way in which she pursued being a writer. To a Young Writer. If you like love and fame, shop early, get your shots, don't spit, and pass with care. Avoid at all costs death, breakdown, despair. They'll fall on you, flock peck to pieces, wounded mouse. I always thought so. You know he lacked the drive. It had to come. Dear friends consign you to sanatorium, prison, and the pall. No, keep your chair, tuck your wits in. Say finally, I did outdoer them all. I love that word, outdoer, there at the end. That's sort of quintessential Eleanor Ross Taylor. She will sometimes actually invent words. Mm-hmm. They seem to emerge out of the pressure of experience.
Yeah, outlast and endure as one word. And just the how alive these poems are to sounds. And that's a common place of poetry, that you try to be alive to the sounds of things. But she is in a very unusual and distinctive way.
It's very difficult to write, to make a new sound. Flock peck to pieces, mm-hmm. wounded mouse. Mm-hmm. You can hear her. You know, we said she was in that literary milieu of Lowell and Randall Jarrell and people like that, and they're ghosting this poem. Dear friends consign you to sanatorium. Well, of course, Robert Lowell was in a sanatorium,
yeah.
You know, off and on throughout his life. And there was the notion, which still exists to some extent, of the artist as a gifted and afflicted figure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason why her work has probably remained little known, because she quietly pursued her art and I think in some ways did suffer that gift and affliction and yet
consignment.
Very quietly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, a poem that really struck me the first time I ever saw it was Against the Kitchen Wall. A mothball May, I lean against the kitchen wall, the sacred pear tree on the hill, the skyline, small green wheat, wave running with the wind. From west to east, the greens, spanned out by men on horseback and on foot, men with long staffs, slow motion, searching. The saddles glint. What are they sweeping for? Why coming this direction? Are those staffs guns? If they are after quail or hares, why is their fanning law enforcement grim, as for a felon, a missing person, or one too imbecile to find her way? one who laid waste the safe place by the kitchen wall, bankrupted her May day, malpracticed pear and gifted wheat. I'm waiting, men. I'm a sucker for the arresting last line of a
poem.
Yeah,
that's a spooky one. And bankrupted her May day and malpracticed pear. I love that. She's often asked in interviews whether she experienced prejudice or discrimination. And she says no, that in fact that the men in her life supported her work and she gives great credit to them. And to read her poems in light of that is sometimes confusing, mm-hmm. you know, because a lot of the poems are about being inhibited by being a woman, about masculine pressure, about speaking out. She says, an immigrant from the mother tongue to say so in the silent one in another poem, which is called Woman as Artist.
She was really addressing this stuff, I think, in poetry long before it was commonplace to do so or fashionable or maybe even acceptable. And one of the hallmarks of her work is how different it is from the people in her own circle. She really just broke away from them. I think it must have been overwhelming and difficult, but she did it.
Linda Kuhnhart is new to the pages of poetry. In fact, this is the very first time her poems have been published anywhere.
Well, this is one of those things where, you know, we just read the poems that come in and something just really strikes you and you kind of wake up when you see it. And I don't think either of us knew a thing about her.
No, I didn't. And these poems just sort of, I'd actually read another submission by her before and completely different. And the poems were much more in the vein of contemporary poetry, of sort of what you would recognize as contemporary anecdotal poetry. And then this came out, and it seemed to me almost by a different person. They come from a very different place. We're publishing 5 of her poems in the May issue, and we're going to play her readings of a few of them for you. First up, a poem with a rather ponderous title.
Majolica Lament, or Australopithecus.
The less said about this poem by way of introduction, the better.
Yeah, maybe if you just keep that music in your head, it'll help you. Here's Majolica Lament, or Australopithecus.
The farmer in the dell. The farmer in the dell. Ox trip gastrology, the farmer in the dell. The farmer takes a wife. The farmer takes a wife. Pupa reconnaissance, the farmer takes a wife. The wife takes a child. The wife takes a child. Sweet red electrolyte, the wife takes a child. The child takes a nurse. The child takes a nurse. Cheese futz habitual, the child takes a nurse. The nurse takes a cow. The nurse takes a cow. Flatworm collateral. The nurse takes a cow.
That's not poetry, Don. What the hell is that doing in the magazine?
Oops.
We're going to get some letters about this one. You know, that I think that what struck me, and you tell me if this is the same with you, Don, what struck me when I first read this was, you know, we get things all the time that are sort of conspicuously, consciously antic. And they seem to have no really organic reason for being. And the thing about these poems is they seem like little, well, you'll see in some of the others, they're like little spontaneous, irreducible outbursts of anxiety and delight at the same time.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And actually, there's almost a kind of violence in it. I mean, you know, the farmer takes a wife, the wife takes a child. You know, there's a lot in those lines. It's not just funny, funny stuff.
Yeah. And it's contrasted with this, you know, mostly scientific vocabulary, gastrology and pupa reconnaissance, sweet red mm-hmm. electrolyte.
I think my favorite one is cheese futz habitual, and I was worried that flatworm collateral wasn't as wacky as that, but there's no relationship at all. They're just weird words with that same hi-ho the Dario beat.
Yeah, and if you think that poem was odd, well, hang on to your hats. The slaying is a dreamlike confection that we found hard to make sense of at first.
I don't really understand it either.
You get the feeling that's exactly what she wanted. Here's the slaying.
Once a week, a nurse comes to town to cut up a baklava. I find executives in my pants. The owner chooses a big one, and the nurse hoists it. I find executives in my pants. She climbs up, poises a knife, and when the angle is right, I find executives in my pants. Plunges the Farmington knife, honey gushes out, and I find executives in my pants.
That's a scary little poem.
Yeah, it is scary. It's funny and it's scary. I mean, you can't help but be disturbed with if you're a man in this
yes.
poem. You've got a knife next to the executives in the pants. It you know, calls to mind certain associations.
Yes, it certainly does. And a farming to knife, that's interesting. I looked around a little bit. And, you know, you can have Farmington knives in your drawer in the kitchen, just sort of silverware. But some of them have big 6-inch blades.
Yeah.
You cut up a deer with them or something. So, you know, stay out of this woman's kitchen.
Well, it's like the other one, and it seems to emerge from a dream in a way. I mean, you get a dream sense of these poems, although that's misleading because it's not a dreamscape at all. The lines are very sharply drawn in her poems. I find it compelling. I find that line, "I find executives in my pants," just bizarre and fun to say. And, you know, the sounds of it are great. And
it's also, you know, warns you off discrimination in the workplace, I would say.
Right. Let's play one more very short poem by Linda Kuhnhart. By now you'll know that these poems are not trying to make any sense, though it's impossible for us readers and listeners not to go ahead and try to make some sense of them. This one is called Fifi.
Sand Wars was first published in Flanders, but as Van Bellingen pointed out, eggnog.
I love this little thing. I loved it. You actually, you've got some information on
that. I looked up a few things. I'm sure all this is wrong. You know, some people might object to references in a poem, things you have to look up. But for me, that's part of the great fun of it. And I didn't know anything about this, and I could be wrong. But I think Sand Wars refers to a series of military sci-fi books. I don't know if they were published first in Flanders, but Van Bellingen is Wouter Van Bellingen, who's a Flemish politician, a black politician with a Rwandan mother who gave him up for adoption. He's very controversial, but as far as eggnog, I don't know. Just wait until the holidays roll around and maybe it'll...
Yeah, why is it named Fifi, Don? What about that title?
Well, what comes to mind there is Beauty and the Beast, although that may have nothing to do with anything she has in mind. And then I noticed there was a Dutch punk band that had a song called Fifi, so you know, maybe they're listening
right,
to
that's
them.
It.
Flanders, I don't know.
But you do not have to know these things to get this poem. What this poem is, Sand Wars sounds like Flanders. That's why those two are together, whether or not it's real. And I think it's making fun of a kind of critical exegesis in a way, because you got this a name that sounds very fancy, Van Bellingen. You think, oh, that's a scholar. And the thing that he's pointing out is eggnog, which is funny.
Yeah,
it's a funny little
lovely
poem.
Lovely four-line poem, and you can spend hours on it,
Andrew,
or minutes.
Yeah. Andrew Hudgens has two poems in the May issue. His recent books include one called, startlingly, Shut Up, You're Fine, Poems for Very, Very Bad Children.
He has two poems in our May issue, and we're going to hear both of them. The first is called The Funeral Sermon.
This is a poem about my father's death, though my father is not dead.
Poets do take liberties.
I took my father-in-law's funeral sermon, which was infuriating, and applied it to my father, who had some similarities to my father-in-law. But the details of my father's life are all exactly true to his life.
We couldn't help but wonder if Andrew Hudgens' father might, you know, read this poem about his own death and funeral.
No, and he never will.
He's not a subscriber?
I guess not. Well, here's The Funeral Sermon by Andrew Hudgens.
Almost droll in its assault on magisterial, my father's funeral sermon made me prowl, agitated, from bean casserole to escarole salad, then taco casserole and back all afternoon, in thrall to Dad's every growl, cramped certitude and corporal wavering lost to shrill, sacral cant. The pastoral story was Dad's own, though, frail as it is, faith and God steamroll death. His wife's and daughter's role was to die, a trial of faith, not cruel so much as natural, when the supernatural is, as it was for him, literal. His cloistral withdrawal, according to the minister's drawl, was grace, and his temporal forfeitures fat collateral on eternity. It felt surreal. Can there be a funeral without, now, the word surreal? To hear Dad's stoic control and loneliness spiral heavenward on genial praise, real enough for the general, one supposes. An orchestral hymn flared through the stereo's cloth grill. Cold waves over the deep water roll, we sang. Some voices shrill, mine guttural. My brother's slow as a crawl. Our voices one and several. A visceral, not unmagisterial, chorale.
So that's interesting. Did you know that we had the word collateral twice here?
We're reflecting the economic hardship of the times.
I guess so. And when we had flatworm collateral and here fat collateral. It links the poems together. You can hear these lines. You know, the first thing you notice, at least if you're looking at this on the page, I hope you could hear it as he was reading it, is that these lines all are broken on L sounds, droll, magisterial, funeral, prowl, casserole, escarole, all the way down.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess it emanates from that word funeral that just sort of unravels or unfolds in the discomfort of being there and sitting through something like this.
I'm a little puzzled by the beginning. Almost droll in its assault on magisterial. That's the word magisterial. Magisterial is italicized. And that word comes from magisterium, which is the authority to teach religious doctrine in Catholicism. And it's as if the authority in this poem is acquired by the people singing, but clearly not given to the people you think have the authority, who's the preacher, right?
Yeah. I mean, the occasion itself, as it sort of has been spun out in this setting, undermines that authority because, you know, really what you've got there is the bean casserole and the escarole salad and taco casserole.
Yeah, and shrill sacral cant.
Yeah, and people who can't sing.
Yeah. So it's a poem about the inadequacies of particularly American death. I've certainly seen this in my family. You go to these funerals and they're so contrived.
Or surreal, as the poem says.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's hear one more poem by Andrew Hudgens.
This is a poem about going to a party with an old, rich friend and seeing the kind of natural beauty wealth can buy you and thinking about how envy can underlie that relationship. Even with a good friend, you can be envious of them.
Here's Andrew Hudgens reading Grand Expensive Vista.
As we sipped and mingled, regaled with old-fangled canapes and beguiled, or entertained at least by garbled oldies, I disengaged and angled across grass tenderly groomed, past where electric tiki torches gleamed, and alone gazed, now truly beguiled, at my host's grand, expensive vista, mortgaged, yes, and yes, remortgaged. A low gold moon glowed against a plush black sky, gauzed, even filigreed with stars. Gowned in old growth oaks glazed with moonlight over their autumn gilt, the hills glowed in concord with the gold moon. Gowned in old growth oaks glazed with moonlight over their autumn gilt, the hills glowed in concord with the golden moon. I lingered, glad, discomfited and glad at what my friend's greed for beauty afforded me. I argued self against self what they'd gained and lost, and me with them entangled as friendship entangles. I nearly groaned aloud from want before my friend grabbed my elbow. Gorgeous, eh? I grinned and agreed, my voice greased with hidden envy. From behind us, grilled sirloin, pedigreed meat, sublimating on embers, triggered another hunger. Life was not just good, but too good. Aged beef, aged wine after bourbon. We hungered, and all the way back to his engorged glass table, hunger was our guide.
But you can hear the N sounds. This poem is arranged in a similar way, though the sounds are different. And all the sounds are G's and D's because every line ends with those sounds, mingled, regaled, old-fangled, beguiled, gargled. And Hudgens told us that he was going for a very particular effect.
I'm trying to create the lushness of that wealth that buys this lush natural vision, even though they've remortgaged themselves to get it.
You know, one thing that strikes me about this poem is it becomes self-conscious about itself as a poem.
A low gold moon glowed against a plush black sky, gauzed, even filigreed with stars.
That even gives it away because he's suddenly conscious of making the landscape too precious. And it becomes
sort
too
of gilding
sumptuous.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
So the poem, in a way, partakes of this decadence, and mm-hmm. it really is a kind of decadence that he's...
Yeah, it also sort of creates a picture of a decaying grandeur, you know, the lifestyle, let's say, of the 50s and 60s with the tiki torches and canapes, which now just seems hopelessly frayed and old-fashioned.
Yeah. You know, we've mentioned it before, that great quote from Auden about what a poem is a clear expression of mixed feelings.
Mm.
And that's what you get here, that he's celebrating this beauty, and yet there's some kind of maybe schadenfreude. Also, he feels the beauty of his own language, and yet there's something a little bit corrupt in mm-hmm. it.
They're entanglements. You know, he talks about the way friendship entangles, and I guess both of these poems are about the kind of social and familial entanglements we contend with.
David Byspiel is a poet who lives in Oregon, and he's a former editor of Poetry Northwest. For the May issue, he wrote an essay upbraiding American poets for shying away from politics and the public sphere.
Byspiel argues that contemporary poetry's lack of engagement in public life has impoverished poetry and democracy. He joins us by phone from Oregon. Hi, David.
Hey.
David, in your essay, you wrote that when you were editor of Poetry Northwest, it was hard to get an American poet to write about something other than poetry. What were you asking poets to write about, and why was it so hard to get them to do it?
Well, I was asking people to write about other arts, about civic life, about political issues. And by political issues, I mean the rudiments of politics, social action, movement politics, even partisan politics. What I would ask people to do is respond to this issue as a poet. And I think either people felt they didn't have enough knowledge about it, an issue, or they didn't feel it was the poet's role to do this, that there's so much specialization that they left it to the pundits and the political writers and the professional politicians, or they didn't want to say anything controversial. I think in poetry, some people can be kind of gun-shy about upsetting the tribe, and so maybe they just didn't want to be involved, and to be honest, they just didn't want to waste their time writing about something that they didn't feel would advance their careers as poets.
David, in the essay, you say you swore you weren't going to use the expression unacknowledged legislators of the world. And then you say, but perhaps some acknowledged legislating on behalf of mankind wouldn't be such a bad thing either for poetry or for democracy. But how would that work for poets who in our culture really don't see themselves as playing a public role?
I think that when people represent themselves as who they are in public dialogue, they're respected for that. You see this in politics all the time. You see people run for political office, for instance, whose main experience was they ran a business or they were community organizers, and they represent themselves that way. I'm just a mom in tennis shoes is how the senator from the state of Washington, Patty Murray, has always projected herself. But you don't see artists and poets stand up and say, I'm an American poet, and this is how I see the world.
Do you think that's because of the anti-intellectualism of American culture? You know, Richard Hofstadter has that famous book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Culture. And do you think poets are afraid of speaking out because of that?
I definitely think that there is an anti-intellectualism in American life and definitely in American politics. And anybody who enters the political realm, whether it's for dog catcher or senator, you know, can't be so radicalized in their rhetoric. By that, I guess I mean intelligent, that they can't get their message across, whether they're going to win or not. But I also don't mean all of this for elective politics. I think that you can have intellectual debate with the poets participating. I would take a a magazine like the New York Review of Books, which is a possibility. There's just to give an example of someone who does it, there's Charles Simic. And I didn't know about this till recently, but he keeps a blog on their website in which he tends to write about international affairs, especially in Eastern Europe. So he doesn't shy away from intellectualism.
A lot of poets have kind of bad records when they try to play a role in politics. You know, our hero Ezra Pound comes to mind.
A lot of politicians have bad records.
That's a good point. Maybe you've already answered my question, but I mean, are there particular poets who you feel have succeeded in playing this deeper role in American culture and politics?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I'll name a couple, and I named them in the essay. I think Katha Pollitt has. I think Adrienne Rich has. I think Robert Bly has. So there's three who have used their kind of gravitas as poets to speak to things outside of the realm of poetry. And I want to say, too, in all of this, that I don't think this is the calling for every poet. I don't think, you know, anyone would want to suggest that Emily Dickinson should be out there fighting for women's suffrage. But I do think that it's a place that poets can play as citizen poet. And we do shy away from it. We shy away from it, and I think this is part of my answer to the question about anti-intellectualism, because the whole culture seems to be shying away from the rest of the culture. In community after community in the country, citizens have turned inward. And we've taken it to be our calling to turn inward. While we are in our poems trying to speak to issues of the self, people aren't really listening because they're so involved in their own selves. And that I find corrosive. And so somehow reversing that, some poets finding a way to reverse that would be the most renegade radical thing.
You know, I mean, politics are incredibly polarized in this country right now, as you know. And I mean, sort of implicit in your comments so far has been the assumption that poets are specially positioned to heal some of these divisions, especially positioned to speak to this rift. And I guess I wonder why that is, and what is it about poets that makes them so perfect for this?
Well, one of the things I think, Chris, that's missing in our public dialogue is the capacity to do two things. One is to listen to the other side and look for common ground, I guess, to use the cliche. And the other is to respect the aspiration of the other. So I feel that those are two skill sets that are essential for a poet to make poems, to seek common ground, to look for metaphor and comparison, and then to be empathetic. And to bring that skill set, those two skill sets, into public dialogue through writing, through speaking, is something we desperately need in the common weal. And so I think the poets do have a special role to play if we'll just, you know, come out of our garrets and play it.
Thanks, David.
Thanks a lot, guys.
David Beispiel is the author of three books of poems, including The Book of Men and Women from the University of Washington Press. You can read his essay, This Land is Our Land, in the May issue of the magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
Last month, some listeners wrote in about a mistake we made. It wasn't Johnny Cash who originally wrote the song Hurt. It was Trent Reznor, and it was on a Nine Inch Nails album, which I should have known because I had an old girlfriend who put it on a mixtape for me when we weren't doing so well. So keep catching us out and email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherr.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.